This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to episode 70 of Recall This Book, which is another scintillating crossover month collaboration with Novel Dialogue, a podcast co-hosted by me and wonderful Duke scholar Arthi Vade that puts scholars and critics together to explore how novels are made and what to make of them. Way back in spring 2020, that's RTB 53 and 54, we brought you conversations with Turkish Nobel laureate Orhan Pamuk and with Helen Garner, Australia's answer to Doris Lessing, and quite an answer. Now we pluck two gems from Novel Dialogue's second season. 2 weeks from today, you'll hear the boundary-crossing, perennially thrilling Carol Phillips. And today you hear a conversation with none other than Jennifer Egan. So if you like what you hear, navigate over to noveldialogue.org to subscribe on its website or subscribe on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. I should say Egan's conversational partner today is Ivan Kreilkamp, a brilliant Victorianist from University of Indiana and author most recently of A Visit from the Goon Squad Reread, a lovely monograph that is, as its name suggests, all about Egan's best known novel. So Egan herself probably needs no introduction to Novel Dialogue listeners. So I'll just say quickly that her A Visit from the Goon Squad won both the Pulitzer Prize and the Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction in 2011. Her other novels are The Invisible Circus, Look at Me, The Keep, and of course, Manhattan Beach. She's also the author of many, many shorter works and a 1993 short story collection, Emerald City. She was born in Chicago, raised in San Francisco, and currently lives in Brooklyn. So thank you both so much for being here, and welcome to both of you. So I guess as third fiddle, my role now is simply to say, Ivan and Jenny, take it away.
Yeah, thanks so much, John. And thank you so much, Jenny, for doing this with us. This is really exciting for me. I want to start by asking you about a book that I believe you have just recently finished. Can you tell us about that? It's some kind of continuation of A Visit from the Goon Squad or a sequel in a way?
Is that right? I would say that it's more an expansion of the world of A Visit from the Goon Squad, which never really felt done to me. I mean, of course, with any book, it ends up having a kind of cohesive appearance once it's between covers. But the truth is that it's often a pretty messy production. And in the case of A Visit from the Goon Squad, there were a lot of things I tried that didn't work. The PowerPoint chapter, which I think is probably the signature chapter of the whole thing, was a very late add-on. I actually sold the book without that. And so, you know, it sort of felt like it was the best I could do when the clock ran out rather than some sort of perfect whole. And before it was even published, I was already imagining beyond it because there are so many open questions. I mean, there are so many people in it. And the whole principle of it is following, a place or a time or a person that we glimpse from our peripheral vision into a world that is completely theirs. And so it felt natural to let that curiosity continue beyond the confines of the book itself.
Did you have any particular models in mind for, I mean, it's such a tricky thing to return to a fictional world and, you're describing it not exactly as a sequel, but as a sort of something a little bit different. Were there particular versions of that you admired or had in mind?
Well, in a way, you know, it's great that you're a Victorianist. I mean, I look to the 19th century for that. I think about Trollope. You know, his greats, he was the great creator of series of series. And I, you know, I love 19th century fiction. It's always a model for me. I think in part because it has so much swagger to it. You know, it really was a time when being a great fiction writer was like being a rock star and a movie star, you know, and a TikTok star, I guess. Not that that's my medium, all combined. And so I just feel like there was no hindrance or no limit on the greed of imagination at that time. And so I, you know, if you look at Trollope, for example, his Palliser series and his Barchester series, I mean, each one contains many, many thousands of pages of fiction that are related to each other. And then the two series are related to each other, but each one really is its own thing. So there's nothing that outrageous about writing a sibling or companion volume to Goon Squad. I definitely don't think in terms of sequels, though, because the sequel implies that the experience would be richer if you had read the first. I think with this, it makes absolutely no difference. You could read them in either direction or just read one. I will say that I think about J.K. Rowling in the sense that, you know, I was a mom at the time that her books were being published, and I was reading them to my kids. And I just really appreciated the way she stuck with her world, developed it in every way that it could be developed, sort of used all of the table settings she had laid out, as it were, which is something I really think about. You know, are you using everything you've put out for yourself? And I love the thought of doing that. I guess she would be the contemporary equivalent, maybe, of one of those 19th century writers, creating many thousands of pages on expanding a world. Although in her case, the protagonist is, for at least the Harry Potter novels themselves, was always Harry Potter. But I love the thought of trying to do that in a different way.
Jenny, can I just jump in here? Because you've touched on one of the real leitmotifs of this podcast, which is that one of the things we like to ask folks is if you could have a conversation like this with any living or dead novelist, who would it be? And basically, what would you be hoping to get out of a conversation like that? And so you've mentioned both a living and a dead writer there. But assuming you want to stick with a 19th century writer, I was wondering, you know, not just who it would be, but also what tricks of the trade you would want to discuss with someone from that world.
That's interesting. I mean, actually, I think I would go back to the 18th century, right? And I'm finally reading all of Clarissa. Not a short novel.
Pandemic project. I know a lot of people who read it for the pandemic. Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I read Pamela first, which is a little more problematic, but also fascinating. I mean, I should just say that if anyone is curious about what it was like to live in another time, I don't know why they're not just reading fiction published at that time. It is literally a time machine into consciousnesses of other people. It's so incredible. I don't think I appreciated that aspect of it when I was younger. I just thought, well, do I like it or don't I? Can I relate to this or can't I? Those are not the questions I ask anymore. And in fact, it's incredible how much I can relate as a 21st century person to this novel about a woman written by a man, many thousands of pages, all epistolary in the 18th century. Anyway, I would be curious to ask Richardson, you know, what sort of challenges he had in sustaining this insanely long narrative. And also, you know, how he so fully imagined his way inside the mind of a female, because I think he really did it pretty effectively. I mean, I'm only at the end of volume one, so we'll see what I think when I get to the very end. But those are some of the questions I would be interested in. There's an epistolary chapter in the Candy House. So, you know, what I found myself thinking as I worked on that chapter is that In an epistolary structure, you are looking always at the the gap between what people say and what they really want. That's kind of what a communication is, you know? The people are saying certain things, but they also want something when they write a letter or an email. And I don't even specify what the genre of communication is in the chapter of The Candy House. And, you know, Richardson does that so beautifully. So I would be very curious to talk to him about how he came to want to write this, how he imagined himself inside this woman's mind. I don't know much about his life. It's such a step forward from Pamela, which is really an almost cliched version, which also an epistolary novel, but really a little hard to swallow, about this servant, a girl who's repeatedly approached and you know, accosted by her employer, who really almost basically tries to rape her on more than one occasion, and ultimately falls in love with him and marries him. It's a bit much. I mean, it's fascinating anthropologically in thinking about that time, but as fiction, it's not credible. And I don't think it was then, because Henry Fielding, of course, wrote Shyamala,
yeah.
Which is, you know, in a way, a one-line joke, but kind of funny as a send-up of Pamela, basically suggesting that Pamela was laughing all the way to the bank and really was just trying to get this guy to marry her.
But, you know, that's related to the same thing you just said about letters, which is that Shyamala is about the gap between self-presentation and reality. Like, the point of Shyamala is she presents herself this way, but she's really this other way. But that's just what you said about how the epistolary works, which is that the gap between our presentation and our actuality.
Although it's interesting, as I said that about Clarissa, I realized that Clarissa herself is, in Clarissa's letters, there is not that gap, which is interesting. And in that way, she's a somewhat idealized figure, and as is Pamela, to the point of comedy, but not so with Clarissa. So I have to wait and see what I think. Anyway, I guess I find myself thinking all the time about those very early novelists, and wanting to remember and connect with what their goals were, and also just channel their ingenuity and flexibility in drawing whatever forms they saw around them into the novel itself, which it seems to me is why the novel was invented. And you can't do that with epic poetry.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I do think your PowerPoint chapter or Black Box have that same feel. I mean, it's a little bit like epistolary fiction, where you're responding to existing communication forms and sort of remediating them or using them for your own purposes. And there's a similar dynamic of gaps in those as well, where we have to read between the lines in terms of what's not there.
Yeah, I think what I love is inadvertent storytelling, or the appearance of inadvertent storytelling, where the speaker is trying to do one thing, but the reader is gathering a story at the same time. I'm always interested in, as a general principle of fiction, how can as many things as possible be going on at once? That is like an aesthetic goal of mine always. You know, how many things can we have happening here? Once we've established something, it's time to move on. It's not time to dig in. And so I'm always thinking that way. And so, inadvertent storytelling really embodies that, because it's someone doing something, but it's the reader understanding something else at the same time.
There's a blurb on Manhattan Beach from the Washington Post, or the reviewer said, it dares to satisfy us in a way that stories of an earlier age used to. And I was thinking about that line and wondering, do you think about different ways fictions used to satisfy and ways that it now satisfies? And I mean, obviously one way to think about that would be in terms of, you've already mentioned the sort of larger media landscape, and, you know, obviously to be a novelist today is to be competing with Netflix and so many other forms, not to mention TikTok. I mean, do you think have the goals fundamentally shifted, or how do you think about those questions?
I don't think they have shifted, in the sense that really good fiction is its own thing, and nothing else can really do what it does. And that is put you inside the consciousness of another human being. in a narrative way. Nothing else can do that. Until something else can, I think fiction will have a life. Although I will say, I think streaming and people's interest in streaming is connected to the same wish, because you're looking at what someone else is looking at on their screen and you're hearing their thoughts as they play a video game or play chess. And it's very compelling, and it's a little frightening to me, because I think, wow, okay, this is where the screen addicted person, and we all are to some degree, can actually have that sensation of being inside another consciousness without ever turning to fiction.
I mean, on the one hand, you know, one thing I really like about your work is the way you're and I do think this is very novelistic, and you know, goes back to sort of very longstanding tendencies of fiction, that quality of sort of appropriating or seizing forms or remediating forms, yeah, for its own purposes. But I think part of what you're saying is that, you know, fiction needs, any form needs to maximize its own form. It needs to bring those other things in, but then do what it does best. And if you're just weakly, you know, like it's, if your PowerPoint chapter were just trying to be a good PowerPoint presentation, it would not be very interesting.
Right, exactly. I think, I mean, the PowerPoint, in a way, the PowerPoint challenge was a little different in that it was really impossible to write very well in PowerPoint for a long time. I mean, it's just hard to use a form like that to bend it towards storytelling unless you're telling a story that can't be told any other way. I think if fiction writers are trying to do things like use PowerPoint, I would already say that's not TV fiction, because it's just not the easy route.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do. And even if it doesn't work, I still would really honor the effort, whatever it might be.
I mean, the novel is so bound up in spying and overhearing and eavesdropping and so on. And I feel like you sort of channel that history in really interesting ways. But then, so on the one hand, there's, you know, fiction's investment in privacy violations and spying, but I also sense a really strong valuation of privacy in your work. So, I mean, one example of that would be the ending of Look at Me. Let me just read a sentence or two. Life can't be sustained under the pressure of so many eyes. Even as we try to reveal the mystery of ourselves, to catch it unawares, the truth has slipped away, burrowed further inside a dark, coiled privacy that replenishes itself like blood. It cannot be seen, much as one might wish to show it. It dies the instant it is touched by light. So that kind of relates to streaming too, the question of like what we give up when we open ourselves up, we open our minds up to other people. So yeah, just to throw that at you, could you reflect a little bit about privacy violation versus privacy and how fiction connects to that?
Well, I guess, you know, it feels to me like it's a kind of paradoxical aspect of being human, especially in a time that in which contemporary life is more and more pervaded by image culture, which is, you know, a curiosity to know about other people and a corresponding wish, which I don't share personally, but which many people do, to reveal ourselves, to be known in a really deep and intimate way by as many people as possible. I mean, that is a cultural wish that really seems to exist. I don't personally feel it, but I'm very interested in it because it's fascinating. But of course, there's, you know, the nature of self-revelation is that it is performative. And so there's a kind of paradoxical quality to it, even with streaming, where we have the illusion and perhaps to some degree reality of someone's reactions to what they're doing, and they're real. Like if someone makes a bad move in chess, it's very satisfying to be watching the chessboard. I have a son who plays a lot of online chess and also watches streamers play. It's very satisfying to watch the bad move, watch them realize that they made a bad move, and see the facial reactions, and then hear their, you know, miserable wailing in response, because it's like we're right in there. But it's the audience is always there, and there, of course, there's an awareness of that, and streaming is performative, and streamers get offline and have their own lives too. So that paradox is always interesting to explore, and the will towards self-revelation is in a way always disappointed, if you will, by the fact that we can't do it. We're locked inside our own consciousness no matter what we do. In a way, fiction, I think, is a more honest way of approaching the wish to experience other consciousnesses. And maybe in the case of autofiction, which I don't write, and I certainly can't speak for what drives that aesthetic, but maybe part of it is a sense that that is the best way to actually reveal oneself, that it's more honest to do it artfully than to, you know, pretend a kind of artlessness that is in fact, you know, illusionary.
One thing I really admire about your work is the intelligence and range and interest in the way you work with the genre. And you play with genre in interesting ways and move around among genres.
I feel like genre is a kind of lifeline for me, because what I can't stomach is the feeling that I'm doing the same thing twice. And at a certain point, you know, I worry that I'm just going to run out. Like, what else am I going to do that I'm able to do without veering into any genres that involve the visual, which I'm open to, but I don't really see myself doing. Like, I absolutely will not write for television. That is a very strict principle, because I'm worried about internalizing those formulas, even though people will tell you there are no formulas. I don't believe it. And I'm worried about being able to shed those. So anyway, for me, what's so great about genre is it's a kind of ready-made world where there are rules, which is fun, but where the challenge is how to sort of use those rules and yet somehow bend them and work around them as well as with them, which is always what people who write in a genre, I think, are trying to do. There's nothing amazing about that goal. I think that's the fun of it. But for me, it just feels like a genre is a portal, let's say. We're talking about portals. A genre is a portal into a world where if I've never worked in it before, it's going to feel new. And there's the possibility that I might be able to do something interesting there that I haven't done before.
Yeah. I mean, the Keep is maybe the clearest example of that, where it's such a clear engagement with the Gothic. And I know people who've ended courses on the Gothic with the Keep and felt it worked really well. Did you feel that, you know, the sort of historical fiction mode of Manhattan Beach was the same kind of genre, or is it a looser one or less?
It had a slightly looser relationship to genre in that, I mean, with the Keep, I knew I was going to write a Gothic novel. I read nothing but Gothic work for years. It was a pleasure and an appetite that was, I enjoyed reveling in for that period. So that was very clear. With Manhattan Beach, I would say that the portal genre, if you will, was the noir.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in sort of World War II New York through a noir lens. And some of that arose, there was always a dialectic between the research and the story, because I begin without any idea what my plot will be. So, I don't know, but I use a lot. The one autobiographical aspect of my fiction is that I really use times and places that I know from my life. So I felt kind of hamstrung, even though I did have genre to help me, an idea of New York during World War II through the lens of the noir. That was not enough for me to do anything, because I didn't have any access to that period. So I did some research very early, actually while I was still working on The Keep, not to speak of Goon Squad, and certain refrains began to emerge right away. You know, the waterfront, because that's really where commercial life still took place and most travel at that time. And then arising from the waterfront, you know, crime for sure. It was, you know, corrupt in multiple ways and from multiple angles. Women doing war work, that arose very naturally. You know, shipping, although I tried to resist that because I had a sense that that was going to really cost me a lot of time and energy, and it did. I barely even sailed in my life. I know nothing about boats. So those elements emerge naturally. But the thing that was really surprising genre-wise about Manhattan Beach was that once I had one sign, I should say, that I was going to go to sea in the book, despite my fervent wishes not to, was a sudden and just acute inclination toward fiction of the sea. Mm. And so, of course, that is a genre too. And, you know, there's a certain feeling I get when I'm in the right area of something that's going to help me with fiction, a kind of excitement. And that started to happen around anything to do with boats or shipping. So Moby Dick, oh my God, I was in transports. Patrick O'Brien, even though completely the wrong era, not even the right kinds of boats, it didn't matter. Endless oral history accounts of people lost at sea from all periods. So all of that became really exciting. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, I've already got a genre going here. How can I work in these two different genres? Alfred Hitchcock did it in Lifeboat. It is noir, it is in a lifeboat, it is at sea. It is not his best movie. Yeah. Because the noir is very urban genre, I think, in its nature. It's an existential threat that comes from human life and kind of human evil. But what I realized is that actually sea stories are totally analogous. It's a situation that is inherently dramatic, in which an existential threat exists at all times, but it's diametrically opposite in that the existential threat is coming from the natural world. It's a pocket of humanity surrounded by danger. Mm. The danger is exactly of the opposite kind. So the fusion of those two genres actually ended up making sense to me intellectually, which was a relief. And so I would say that that book is, somewhat genre-esque in many of its parts.
That's interesting. This also reminds me of something else I want to ask you about, which has to do with subcultures and lingos and dialects and jargons, which in a way, I mean, it's a slightly different topic, but maybe related in that every genre has sort of an idiolect or a dialect. And I find that this seems something you're quite interested in. I mean, like there's a good line in Manhattan Beach, Dexter is electrified by the hidden landscape he discovered, a latticework of codes and connections that shrank the everyday world into non-existence. And I feel like there's many moments like that in your fiction where a character sort of stumbles on a private world and it comes with a secret language. And could you maybe speak to jargons and codes and how those operate in your work?
I mean, I think in a way, any genre is in a sense about learning a language, learning the language of that genre and then somehow transcending it so that what one does is not just a generic reiteration of the genre, but actually does something, somehow pushes into something that feels new. And in a way, I think some of this really may come from my experience as a journalist, because I have done a fair amount of journalism. I've moved away from it in recent years, and I'm not sure whether I'll go back to it or not, because as I do more historical work, I really have to spend a lot of that research time doing the research, which I approach in very similar ways to the way that I would approach journalism. But the kinds of journalism that I did for the New York Times Magazine really involved walking into a complex world knowing nothing and being therefore kind of incompetent to represent it in any way, and acquiring a brief expertise and in all aspects of a thorny problem, and often a subculture. Those are my favorite kinds of articles. And then distilling that into a fairly long but really relatively short, given the complexity of real life, article that a general reader could read and learn from. And that feeling of starting out knowing nothing and feeling completely confused by everything that I'm being told, to go from that in a matter of a couple of months to a sense of actually understanding very clearly what the situation is that I'm trying to understand, that acquisition of knowledge is so exciting. And I think it's been a really formative discovery for me. And it kind of gets back in a way, I don't know if it really relates or not, but this sort of question of what motivates a person to write fiction, you know, again, with the journalism that I was doing involves a kind of self-erasure, or that was how I experienced it. You know, I just forgot who I was or where I came from to just try to understand what was around me. And often I would actually sort of behave in chameleon-like ways that I wasn't even fully aware of. Like, as one example, when I was writing about Catholic seminarians and spending lots of time at this very conservative seminary where there were only men, it was Catholic, one of the guys pointed out to me that I had taken to wearing black slacks, a black V-neck sweater, and a white t-shirt. Basically, I was wearing clerics without even consciously realizing it. So that's my inclination, is that kind of camouflage. And so that is very much what motivates me as a fiction writer as well. The transformation, the escape and kind of shedding of my life in order to enter a world where I become expert briefly. That's what the whole thing is for me. That's what the joy is. What I think fiction actually does. I mean, I've talked about the advantage that I think it has that other forms don't, but what I actually think it is, and this is over time, I've sort of come to this view, I really think it's a kind of a dream life, a collective dream life of the larger culture. It's a narrative that pulls together all kinds of different forces that are acting on all of us and transmutes them into a symbolic, into a narrative with symbolic meaning, which none of us writers often really understand. We understand some of it, but if it's really good, there should be a lot of stuff in there that we're not even aware of. And so I do think that, you know, fiction writers are conduits as much as anything else, and crystallizers of an enormous amount of information that's operating through us. And our job is really just to do that, to be as open as possible, to bring in as much as possible so that these artifacts end up being rich immediately and over time.
I think that stream, conduit, and portal makes a really great set of metaphors here that sort of knits everything together. But Jenny, maybe I can just pivot to the very last moment here by asking you, we have basically a signature question for the podcast, and it's meant in the broadest sense. It's, what is your favorite treat while you are in the midst of writing? So in other words, what do you do, or what do you play, or what do you eat when the going gets really tough for you?
Oh, wow. See, this is where I should have done my homework and had an answer ready for you. A treat. What is a treat? Oh, you know, in a way, this is an easy one. It's kind of gardening, actually. I like to first of all, I like to work outside. And because I write fiction by hand, I am mostly not using a machine. And so it's easy to write wherever. I like to be outside. We have a tiny little Brooklyn backyard that we have access to. And I'm often, you know, over distracted by composting, worms, weeding, you know, some sort of engagement with these small tasks of trying to create a physical landscape that is to my liking. And during the pandemic, the one new development that's been pretty enormous is a quasi obsession with birds. You know, I always thought birding seemed really boring, but I now realize that, to continue with our metaphors, birding is sort of like a portal into another dimension, the bird dimension, which is always present, but one can go through one's whole life and not even think about it. Yeah. Once I have found that once I was aware of it, I'm distractingly attentive to it in every circumstance. so that I'm sort of always listening for birds. I feel that it really has expanded my world.
I mean, there's a jargon for you, right? Birdsong. I mean, it's like an argot, you know?
Absolutely.
Incredible.
You know, you're talking to a pair. We're not just connected by being Victorianists, but we're also chicken owners, Ivan and I. So we're with you on this one. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. The idea of finding eggs. I can't even imagine. Yeah. People actually do keep chickens in Brooklyn, but we have cats. So that would be a bit of a bloodbath.
Yeah. Oh, chickens and cats usually get along fine. You just have to get big enough chickens.
Wow. Yeah. Actually, I believe that because our cats are terrified of squirrels.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They can usually hold their own. Yeah.
So I would say it's gardening. Gardening is the perfect antidote to fiction writing.
Here I am again, wearing the hat of Recall This Book host, to thank Arthi Vade and the Novel Dialogue team for that crossover episode. I'll also quickly add that Recall This Book is sponsored by the Mendel Humanities Center here at Brandeis. Music comes from Eric Chaslow and Barbara Cassidy, sound editing by Naomi Cohen, website design and social media by Nai Kim. So from all of us at Novel Dialogue and at Recall This Book, thanks for listening.